Hello, Michael McKenzie here. Like a lot of us, it takes me about an hour and a quarter to get to work. I drive to a train station, I catch a service that in the morning runs about every 25 minutes, I get off in the city, and I walk to where I'm talking to you now. I've been doing this for 15 years. It's quicker than driving at peak times, but after 7 p.m. there's only one train back to my house every hour. I'm lucky. I literally live at the end of a line. But for hundreds of thousands of other Australians in our cities and beyond, the car, if they can afford to run one, is the only viable way to commute. It's too far by bike, and the bus, train or trams are already packed to the gunnels. The pickup point means driving anyway. So what needs to happen to make our public transport systems work better and work equitably? What examples have you seen in this country or overseas where all suburbs of a city or town are well serviced with train, bus, tram or ferry? Tell us where public transport is actually doing the job it was designed to do. And what lessons can we learn from where planners, developers and governments have got this right? The first of two guests, and what John Stanley doesn't know about public transport really isn't worth knowing. John is a professor of transport and logistics studies at the University of Sydney. His book is called How Great Cities Happen, and John spent many years as a professional in the transport industry. John was awarded an Australian Centenary Medal for services to public transport, and John, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, Michael.
What's the current state of play, John, when it comes to our public transport systems across the country? Are they fit for purpose?
Well, Michael, I think what's been happening is our cities have been changing quite dramatically, and our public transport systems haven't kept up with that.
How so?
If you look at the sorts of changes that are happening, our economy is changing. The rapid job growth now is in knowledge-intensive jobs, and they tend to be concentrated in the inner suburbs and the CBD.
Where the public transport systems are usually pretty well established.
Where the trunk services serve pretty well, but the offset, though, is that we've had very high population growth, particularly so in Melbourne. I mean, Melbourne's added about 1 million people over the last decade.
I think it's one of the fastest growing cities in the world.
I haven't been able to find one that's growing faster for its size and level of development. But one of the problems is that most of that growth is still happening in the outer suburbs. So people are moving to the outer suburbs where there aren't the jobs and where public transport is really playing serious catch-up. So we don't have local bus services. In fact, in some cases, you have bus stops and no buses servicing those stops.
Are you serious?
Absolutely.
So people go along to a bus stop because it's there thinking it means there's a service and there is no service.
Well, I think they know there's no service there, but it's in anticipation of one coming someday.
Right.
Trains have been extended out into some of those growth services, but this is still playing catch-up. And the point you made, this is really building in car dependence. Now, for those people who don't have a car or can't afford to operate one, there is a real risk of social exclusion in that situation. And we're also building in very high emissions in the greenhouse gas sense. And with the daily tidal flows of traffic from the outer suburbs coming into the inner and middle suburbs, we've got huge problems of congestion.
Now, you've talked about Melbourne there, but I take it these kind of issues are raising their head in Brisbane, City, in Canberra,
Sydney, absolutely.
Sydney, everywhere?
Absolutely. It's really just a question of scale as you go around the other cities. And I'll be interested to get your listeners' views on, you know, how they're experiencing that, because that's the sort of thing that's happening. And governments are playing catch up. I mean, the Victorian government now is spending three times what it did a decade ago to transport capital improvements, mainly rail.
We're talking about billions here.
We're talking about 30 to 40 billions committed. Which is serious money. Also, some very major spending on road projects as well. So the North East Link in Melbourne, West Connects in Sydney. These are really big projects.
What about other cities like Perth, for example, where I believe there was a fight on for a while there to retain its train service, and that service was retained. I take it that was a good move.
Perth has extended its railway lines to the outer suburbs in Joondalup, for example, and that's given them a trunk service into the CBD. One of the risks, though, with that is you can encourage still further sprawl by building railways well out and then not having high-density living around those railway stations. And I think the answer to our transport problems and our public transport problems in particular is about land use. It's going to be on the land use side, not on the transport side.
What do you mean by that?
It's about shaping our cities so that we have higher densities around our public transport trunk services and higher densities in the growth suburbs. Our growth suburbs at the moment are running at about 18 dwellings per hectare, which is better than it was a decade ago, but we really need to be up around about 25 or 30 If you get those sorts of dwellings per hectare, then you can get more local jobs in the area as well.
And that's interesting.
And you can provide a better local public transport service.
So to talk about public transport as a sort of discrete thing is not possible. You have to look at interlinking it with some of the other social fabric around communities to make this work. John, I might take some calls here. Let's go to Joe, who is in Carlton, I think, in Melbourne. Hello, Joe.
Morning. How are you?
Good. Tell us about Germany.
Look, I've travelled to Germany pretty extensively and done sabbaticals and worked in a number of cities. And if I use, for example, Berlin as an example, they have a well-structured rail and tram system. And so it doesn't really matter where you live in the city. Mm. It's a short walk to a station, whether it's a subway or train, excuse me, and it's a short walk, and the end result is you just don't need a car to live in the centre of Berlin. It's easy access to a well-structured rail system.
Here's a point, Joe, I wanted to ask you, is have you only experienced this from the centre of Berlin perspective, or have you been to the outer suburbs as well?
The outer suburbs, they do have more rail than trams. And if you really go to the outskirts of the city, for example, if it was like South Morang or Melton in Melbourne, it may not be as good. And so if you were going to the outskirts, you might drive.
Right.
But getting around the centre, not so much the centre of the city, it extends a long way through what I call the centre of the city. Its structure is far better than ours.
Ah, that's really good to know, Joe. Let's talk about that in a moment with our guest, because I'd like to go to Adrian in Melbourne. Adrian, you'd like to see something around bus usage for school children.
Yeah, look, I witnessed in small to medium cities in America and Canada years ago, it was almost enforced by social contract or social compact. People just expected the use of school buses, and you take half a million cars off the road at very critical times, save a lot of fuel, save a lot of emissions, and save a lot of parent time if that was enforced in some way.
So are you saying that during those times when cars are taken off the road in these smaller towns or mid-sized towns in the US and beyond, that they were then, that gap was filled with buses, were they?
Yeah, school buses, school bus systems, which were, you know, pretty strongly enforced by a social compact, I suppose.
Right.
There wasn't a force. Boy, why can't we do that in Melbourne?
So the idea being that between the hours of, say, 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., those buses are freely available for the public. Otherwise, they're back on the school run. Sounds good. Adrian, thank you very much for that. We might actually bring in our second guest here as well, who has some thoughts about how we can make some positive contributions to what we do here in this country when it comes to public transport. My next guest is Sandy Vigar. Sandy is a town planning consultant. She's worked for 3 decades on planning for new communities and metro projects, as well as in local government. Sandy is also the former president of the Planning Institute of Australia. She's worked on everything from high rise to shopping centres, theme parks, industrial areas. Sandy, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Michael.
Good to have
you
with us.
Glad to be with you.
Sandy, let's talk about a positive straight away. Let's talk about what's happening outside Ipswich in Queensland and a new suburb called Springfield.
Michael, Springfield is effectively a new city within the city of Ipswich.
Good.
Which has been developed over 25 years or so. And what they've been doing is planning from the outset for the whole range of things that a whole new community might need.
So how does that start? Because we've already heard there from John about too often governments play catch up, where in fact the suburb, the new one, gets established and then slowly, reluctantly, transport links are made to it. In the meantime, people are on roads that aren't meant to be used for major congestion. How is Springfield doing it differently?
Well, Springfield, I guess, is one example of a number of projects which have been taking that approach to new planning. One of the earlier ones that I was involved in was North Lakes on the north side of Brisbane, where in the 1990s we were preparing the first community services planning, which was looking at what does a whole community need to work. And that was making sure that from the outset, things like public transport, but also health and schools community centres and shops, all those things would be in place before the first residents or as the first residents were moving in. And that's crucial to people not needing a second car or hopefully in time a first car.
So let's just make this very clear. So in fact, a rail line was established out to North Lakes, and I think it's happening in Springfield as well. And then, and also education, shopping, commercial areas were being planned for, and then residents were invited.
They were done at the same time. They were contemporaneous, Michael, because what they were looking at doing was the developers of Springfield worked together with state and local government. So that was Ipswich City Council and the Queensland Government to identify all the things that the community might need and to start the long-term planning that would get those in place. Because as you can imagine, for getting things like a hospital or a university or schools, there is a fairly long lead time involved. So all those things were happening at the same time.
John.
Sandy, as I understand it, Springfield's probably the biggest private sector-led development of its kind in Australia as an urban development project. How important has that been in terms of making this work?
I think the economies of scale are critical, and that's one of the things, one of the comments before about that you made, John, in terms of density is an important thing, that you need to have critical mass to be able to provide services. And that's what we're seeing in Brisbane with the increasing density in the inner city areas. In the area where I live, for example, in West End, there's major new developments coming in to increase the population. But that's also having has been ramifications for things like schools, services and the other public transport and commercial services that people need.
I'll come back to both of you in a moment. I want to talk more about this density issue because in Australia, it's almost un-Australian to talk about density, and maybe we need to rethink that. David, tell us about Brighton in England.
Yes, thank you. Yes, it's Brighton on the south coast in the United Kingdom. We, for a number of years, we had a kind of second home there and spent quite a lot of time there. Brighton's a kind of historic seaside resort, and some years ago the Enlightened, it's the size of Canberra, probably a bit larger, and for some years ago the City Council decided that it was not compatible to have a historic place like Brighton and dense motor cars. They didn't go together. So they did three things. First of all, they dramatically increased the cost of parking in the centre of Brighton and made it very difficult to park there, and simultaneously they created a spider's web bus system that was extraordinarily efficient and put out its tendrils comprehensively around Brighton and its near suburbs, so to speak. So there was nowhere that you couldn't go. I mean, and you could go across Brighton as easily as you could go in and out to the centre.
And David, if you lived on the outskirts of Brighton, how long would it take you by bus that's wending its way through those suburban streets to get to the centre of the city?
Yeah, the routes were carefully planned so that I never spent more than about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes on a bus, no matter how far out I went. But the third thing I was going to say that they did that is relatively easy to do is that they put a time of arrival indicator on every bus stop. Oh. So you knew how long you were going to wait for a bus.
And brilliant.
I don't think you can have a bus-orientated transport system without that. It reduces the anxiety about when a bus is going to come, and it gives you options.
I love that, because it manages expectations all the way down the line. David, thank you very much for that. That's great. Alison, I'm going to come to you in Geelong. Tell me about Delhi, because you're the second person who cited New Delhi as a city that's got it right.
I was over there in 2016, and I was very impressed with the way they moved people around with their train system. Huge volumes of people, as you would expect over there. And part of the process of getting on the train involved going through a scanner, you know, for security reasons. But despite that, it worked very efficiently. And I guess one of the things that I've always questioned is why our public transport system, once the temperatures get into the low 30s, that in itself seems to cause problems. But over there, you know, temperatures get up to 50 degrees and it doesn't seem to stop. It still keeps going.
And this is a system that was, of course, brought in by the British Raj, and the Indian nation has followed on with that and kept sort of building on what was there originally from colonial times. And you, it's funny because, Alison, you associate parts of India with, you know, something a little bit ramshackle and groaning at the seams, but it
exactly.
seems, but it's working well.
Yes, but it's a different matter if you get out on the road.
Yeah, oh, yes. All the more reason why you're on the subway.
Yeah, but it works really well. And we travelled out to the outskirts of Delhi and everything seemed to still work very efficiently and trains came very frequently. And, yeah, I was just really impressed with the volume of people that they move and the efficiency that they do it with.
Thank you so much for that story. It's great to hear. My guests as well in the studio, John Stanley, Professor of Transport at the University of Sydney, and renowned town planning consultant Sandy Vigo, who's worked on all kinds of projects, including public transport infrastructure, along with development at the same time. Sandy, I might get you and John to expand on something you've both mentioned now, which is density and the need for critical mass to make that public transport infrastructure be successful. Now, I think, John, you mentioned something along the lines of about 30 people living per acre, hectare?
About 25 to 30 dwellings per hectare.
So that could be about 120 people.
Well, it wouldn't be that many, but it's probably about 3 people per dwelling. So, you know, it's probably around about 75, 80.
So that means, I take it, building up rather than building out.
Not necessarily. You can do that with townhouse-type development quite comfortably. It's really about cleverer design, better use of the sites. At the moment, we're putting, you know, cookie-cutter houses on a lot of these outer-fringe developments with poor use of open space. We could make much better use of open space. There were some really smashing developments done in the 70s by David Yenken and his colleagues at Winter Park, for example, in Doncaster, where they tended to concentrate the
houses. That's in Melbourne.
That's in Melbourne, among trees, but, you know, much more open space, smallish houses, but we're not using the open space at all well now. So you can get density up without going Hong Kong.
Okay, that's interesting. Sandy, what's happened in the cases of North Lakes and Springfield when it comes to density?
I think one of the key things is having a mix of densities. And so it's increasing density where you can to provide for a range of housing opportunities. Because one of the difficulties that we have in terms of cities is housing affordability, as everybody knows.
Yes.
And so one of the opportunities that you can have with a range of housing types is to include housing opportunities for at a lesser cost. And so having a range of those increases the range of people who can perhaps live within the city areas and consequently have greater range of opportunities.
But Sandy, density is one thing. Of course, that means you've reached critical mass and that means it also looks like a reasonable place to put your buses, your trams and your trains. But at the same time, if local and state governments are, you know, traditionally playing catch up anyway, are they going to be prepared generally to have that public transport infrastructure ready to roll?
It's a really difficult challenge for governments. And having started out my career at Gold Coast City Council at the time when there was up to 1,000 people a week moving to the area, it was quite challenging. And so I think that there's always going to be a difficulty in terms of providing for people who are already in an area and providing for people who are moving in. And I think that there are opportunities. It's become pretty standard now for new developments to be providing towards the infrastructure, but providing the actual, you know, buses, trains, and so on is a challenge for governments. One of the things I'd perhaps like to mention is some of the things that Brisbane City Council is doing. I think that Brisbane is, by virtue of its large size, has opportunities and a large budget in terms of public transport. And I think they're doing some really interesting things. And so, for example, they do have a real-time app where you can find at any point where your bus is and when it's likely to arrive. And while you're along the route, you can it can tell you which bus stop to get off and those sorts of things.
Cool.
There's also they've introduced free off-peak travel for seniors because cost of transport is a a difficulty for people on fixed incomes. And so that's encouraging seniors to get out and use public transport in off-peak periods. They've introduced high-speed, what they call city glider services, and Busby UZ routes, which are high-frequency services. So at the end of my street, I can go to the end of my street, and every 5 to 10 minutes, from early in the morning till late at night, there will be a bus.
So no need for a timetable, because you know it's just going to come.
It's going to be coming.
Yeah, it's not long away. Sandy, hold that thought, because I want to take some more calls. Albert is on the northern beaches of Sydney, I believe. Albert, what's been your experience in a city as exotic as Rio?
Well, I remember watching a documentary, and I was using suspended cable cars.
Yeah.
And working very well, and you can build it over the infrastructure already there, so to put the actual cable car in is relatively easy as compared to a light rail or a heavy rail. And it just seems like the perfect solution to me, which we consider, because it's old technology, like old skiing technology that's been using for years.
Yeah.
But they transported, you know, thousands of people very quickly and very efficiently, and could put the infrastructure in fairly quickly and efficiently as well.
So in Rio, are the cable cars going everywhere?
Yeah, they're like a spider web.
Right.
And transporting, because they had a real problem with density, like on the northern beaches here. But that kind of alleviated that problem, because you just go over the top of it all, just in the middle. It's, you know, relatively easy to set these suspended systems up.
I love the idea. I must say, the idea of looking down on all the congestion below, that would give me a wonderful sense of superiority. Albert, thank you very much indeed for that. Sounds really interesting. Edna's also in the northern beaches of Sydney. Tell us about some of your experiences in Asia, Edna.
Look, the little buses. I don't know why we have to have such great big vehicles. Little buses, and I would presume in Asia, and we've seen them throughout, that these are private businesses, and they cover an area, and they just run round all the time. You go out and you know that there's a bus coming because someone's got that area covered.
Well, that's
and
interesting.
We travelled everywhere by public transport, so we had quite a bit of experience with that. But we also were in a cable car, and I think it must have been South America, so I'm not surprised to hear that call.
So small buses and cable cars seem to be part of the answer for this.
Yes, I think so. And it opens it to private enterprise.
Indeed.
I would think these would have been private enterprise.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those private-public partnerships in a moment. Let's head over now to Colin in Canberra. And Colin, you're a town planner.
Yes, I've spent a good deal of time in that field, and I know Sandy from my time in Queensland. So hello to you, Sandy. I'd like to endorse everything that both John and Sandy have said. I'd just like to introduce one other sort of dimension, I think, of the problem, and that is the fact that for a long period of time in Australia, governments, local and state and the current federal government responds to growing congestion problems by spending vast amounts of money on new and upgraded road infrastructure.
Yep. We've done a story about this, Colin, where, in fact, you build a new road and in 6 months it's just as congested as the road it replaced.
Oh, precisely. And the highway between Brisbane and the Gold Coast is vivid testimony to that. And I was driving back from a sporting event on Sunday night and coming through the new northern suburbs of Canberra where just this is happening. A lot of money, new road infrastructure. It's extremely disruptive. And I think it's short-term thinking because it means that there's insufficient money left for good public transport of the type which John in particular has discussed. And I think that it confirms the arguments that both Sandy and John have made about the solution to achieving good public transport lies in appropriate land use planning.
Yep. Colin, thank you very much.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Look, thanks so much for that, Colin.
That's all right.
Town planner by trade as well, I know, Sandy. John, I might come back to you. A number of points raised there by callers. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'd like to pick up on Colin's point about, I think our politicians are having a bit each way. So they're spending money on public transport and they're spending money on roads as well. And Colin's exactly right that once you build more big roads, essentially you generate more traffic. And so you don't actually solve the problem from a long-term point of view.
Because it's an inducement to
drive.
It
induces additional traffic, exactly.
Right.
And there's been plenty of evidence around the world sure that that's the case. And you've really got to decide what sort of city do you want and then plan your transport networks to help you get that kind of city. And we're not doing that. Sydney, I think, is starting to. Sydney, for example, has designated three cities within Greater Sydney and is talking about trying to get 30-minute access to those cities. Melbourne has designated a number of clusters throughout the middle suburbs that I was involved in. But there's really not much happening to make those clusters work in Melbourne, whereas Sydney's actually putting a more concerted effort into building up those clusters. And I think the importance of the clusters is with knowledge-based jobs, you don't want them all to be in the CBD,
no,
which is miles away from the edge of the city where all the growth's happening. So if you can get those clusters happening throughout the city, and you're going to have a more equitable city and also a more productive city. So I think that's...
So it's a second or third CBD.
Exactly
where
it is.
Where you would commute to that might be only 20 to 30 minutes. Sandy, I might come to you because I want to talk about something called the last mile. This is something I referred to at the front of this story where I actually drive to my train station to get on the train. And if I don't get there at the right time, there's no car parking spaces in that car park. This is something that many people who use public transport across Australia face these days. They want to do the right thing, but when they get to, you know, where they need to park, not there. What are some solutions around the last mile?
I think the heart of it really is, Michael, it's the planning for people rather than planning for cars. And I think a lot of the approaches that have been taken have been dealing with how do we deal with cars. As you've said, that you're going to the station, you're driving to the station. I think part of the solution is looking at the whole range of ways that people might get to public transport. So that it might be walking, it might be cycling, it may be cars, it might be other services.
Well, Edna, our caller Edna, mentioned having these, you know, small local buses in parts of Asia.
Absolutely. And so it could be small local buses. There's an initiative that Brisbane Council, again, has, which is called Community Cabs. And so on certain times, anybody who meets the criteria can ring up on a Tuesday or a Thursday, and for $2 they can be a shared taxi, which takes them to their local centre or to their local public transit. And so those sorts of things are options to get people that last mile. The issue of parking at public transport is a vexed one, and I don't think we're going to solve it this morning.
No, probably not. We could have a go, but I think you're right. John, electric scooters?
Can I, before we do that, Michael, we've developed in Melbourne the idea of 20-minute neighbourhoods, where you can get most of the things you need for a good life within 20 minutes by walk, cycle or public transport.
And is it a theory or is it a proven concept?
It's a theory.
Okay.
It's a theory.
Right.
But a fundamental element of it, well, there are two fundamental elements of it. One is those densities I talked about before, but the other is actually having local public transport that meets that kind of 20-minute timetable frequency. So, for example, where you live, you ought to be able to get on a bus that meets your train. And if you can get on a bus that meets your train, then you won't need a car park. And the cost of actually putting networks in across Melbourne, as an example that I've looked at, is about 10% of what we're spending on major rail upgrades to do that. It's not massively expensive.
So the return on investment is worth your while?
Well, it's well worth it in terms of the social return and getting people out of their cars, yeah.
Okay, I want to talk about dollars again in a moment, but let's take some more calls on this now. Peter's in Ballina in New South Wales. Peter, like Edna, have you experienced school buses in Thailand? Have you?
Yes, I spent about 7 years up there recently, but... Yeah, the thing I was going to talk about was the small buses that somebody mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
They're used in the mornings a lot by school kids going to their schools. But they have bus stations, and one for the local area and another one for travelling between centres of, you know, population. And the other thing, of course, is that driving, even when driving using your car, it's an idea to park not close into the centre of the city, but get park your car somewhere where there's not high restrictions, and then grab a motorcycle taxi or a tuk-tuk.
I've done this, Peter, and I'm sure many people travelling through places like Thailand have done this as well. They're noisy. They're efficient, yeah, in some ways, but they also produce an awful lot of smoke and pollution.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not talking about doing exactly the same thing, of course, but making improvements on their system, including air conditioning and a little bit larger for the small buses that the kids use.
Yeah.
So that they're a little bit more comfortable. But not to take up so much space on the highway or on the train or roads as our buses do, which are, in a lot of cases are running almost empty. You've got large buses.
Yeah.
And
depending on the time of day and their route. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, Peter, that's a good point. I'm all for now, I've just decided, electric tuk-tuks. That would be great. Let's find out what other people are saying. Rosemary is in Gordon in Sydney. Hello, Rosemary.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. Now, your father had a really cool idea a few decades ago.
Yeah, several decades ago, he decided that we should have, like someone's already said many times, small buses that just meander around a certain route around the suburb, and you can go out of your... you know, go out of your door and catch it when you want to.
Well, Sandy sort of mentioned this happening in parts of Brisbane where you don't even
Brisbane
need a timetable.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Brisbane's got all the right things happening.
Yeah. So so you'd like to see this taking off around the country?
Well, I've seen it working in Mossman, which is a, you know, I know it's a very wealthy suburb and they've got gas-driven buses there. But it's the same idea. It's just free buses that go round a loop, several of them, and you just step out when you want to and catch it, and it takes you to the shops or the ferry or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm close to the Gordon station, so there's trains and buses close by, but getting there, you've
That's
got to either
catch.
Walk or drive.
That's right. Rosemary, thank you. Paul's in Wagga. I should say Wagga Wagga. Paul, tell me about Hong Kong.
Well, when I was working in Hong Kong a while back, they had trains going every 5 minutes at any time of the day. And so what it meant was that you could just walk down to the train station and jump on a train. You didn't have to plan laboriously your route using any apps or anything like that. You could just catch trains. So people used it a lot more.
Can I play devil's advocate here and say, too, Paul, this is all about population density. Hong Kong is one of the densest cities in the world, so you're not going to have the kind of shifts of population in peak times versus down times that you do in a place like Australia.
Certainly you won't, but what I noticed is that in Australia you often just say, oh, it's just too hard once you get outside peak hour
True.
To catch a train, and you just don't bother, and so you just plan around it.
Yeah.
And even if we were able to take some of those cars off the road, it would be better. The other way to do it is to do what other countries do and say, okay, well, we're going to go and decentralise and have a whole lot of smaller cities rather than one big city per state.
Which is what John was alluding to, where some of the larger cities like Melbourne are now talking about sort of clusters or hubs that are like a mini version of a CBD where workers can find jobs and therefore don't have to travel as far. Paul, thank you. That's really good news to hear that stuff going on. Perry's in Maroubra. Perry, Budapest. Haven't been myself. Tell me more.
Interesting place. I wouldn't put anybody off it. I didn't find the food very interesting, but the transport was. No, actually, it's the first thing when Westerners get together, they all complain crazily about the food there. But
at least they got to the food place on time because of public transport.
They did. And what you just mentioned is really salient to that. It's hubs. They have these fabulous hubs. So they've got above ground rail, they've got metro rail, they've got trams, they've got trolley buses, they've got diesel buses, and they all go in and out of these hubs. Mm. And I could fly across. It's not a big city, okay, not compared to Sydney, but I could fly across Sydney. A car was a complete liability. I had a car. I managed to leave it at my wife's parents' place. They had a place up in the hills. And you just couldn't park it anywhere, you know.
So why would you? You wouldn't take it, especially if public transport hubs are working together in concert.
No,
Perry, thank you very much. That's great.
Sure.
John Stanley, I'm going to come back to you. I thought that last caller had made a really interesting point about hubs. How good are we are intersecting public transport, modes of transport together so you can move from one to the other?
We're not very good at all. So you find if you look at the frequencies on buses, for example, that are coming into hubs where trains are going through, very rarely do they coincide. It's very unusual to have frequencies that align fully. So that's really, it fails the system in that sense.
And John, is that partly due to the fact that while state governments might own the infrastructure, they lease out the services often to private companies who have their own timetables, their own schedules?
Well, now the governments really determine the timetables.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they wanted to make it happen, they could. and it's not nearly as expensive as they might like us to think. So it's really a case of, you know, having the will to decide, hey, that's the way you want your city to work.
Yeah.
At the moment, we're providing good trunk service, but as a lot of the callers have pointed out...
Just explain trunk. What do you
trunk
mean?
Trunk is going from the hub to the central business district, or from the edge of the city to the central business district. What we don't have is the little feeders, and a lot of the callers have spoken about that.
Yes. It seems to me like so many of our transport link patterns are spokes and a wheel. They all go out and in, but they don't go round.
They don't go round. And circumferential, our cities have evolved so that you actually need to be able to go both directions, and at the moment you can't.
Sandy Weigart, can I talk to you about return on investment? Because, you know, as we're seeing, when you retrofit better public transport systems to cities around the country, you are often forced to go underground, and that can cost you billions of dollars. Are we getting good return on investment if we start to retrofit better public transport to our cities?
As a general rule, yes. It depends on the particular projects. It depends on them being well targeted. But I think it's interesting that there seems to be a different a paradigm in terms of the way that we view public transport to the way we review funding roads, that roads are seen as an investment, whereas public transport is seen as a subsidy. And I think that we need to see both as an investment and the return on both in terms of both actual services and community benefit.
Is that because you think there's a stigma still in this country that if you catch public transport, it's only because you can't afford to have a car?
I think there may be that view, but I think that in terms of government, it's just, it may be, and John's probably better placed to comment on this, but it just seems to be that the mindset is that the actual the roads are seen as being something tangible, whereas buses and so forth are intangible, and therefore they're a cost rather than an investment. Oh. I don't know, John, have you got a view on that?
I do. I think one of the challenges is that when we evaluate road improvements, we measure small time savings and we add them up and we multiply them out and we get really big numbers, but in fact, mostly they don't eventuate. So that in fact, people take more trips, as we said earlier on, they take longer trips. And so instead of saving 5 minutes, they actually travel the same amount of time, but just go further. And what you get is major freeways leading to increased urban sprawl. And so we're actually evaluating those projects the wrong way. We need to look at their dynamic consequences of what they're actually doing to our city. One of the strong points about investing in rail services to the CBD is that the CBD is where you get most of what economists call your agglomeration economies. That's really the benefits from knowledge, high productivity from knowledge-based activities. Now, our CBDs wouldn't work, the big cities particularly, without the rail systems feeding them. If we didn't have those rail systems, we wouldn't get those productivity benefits of the CBD. So these are really good investments.
Okay. That's good to hear these kind of notices on dollars. Paul is in Manningham in Victoria. Paul, you're a local councillor there.
That's correct. I'm the city mayor at the moment.
Oh, well, excuse me. What would you like to say, Mayor?
Well, I can only agree that we need more substantial investment in bus transport in our cities. Our city is bus bound. It's the only form of public transport we have. We have a successful network, but...
Now, I should explain to people, the Manningham Council region is a suburb in Melbourne to, what, would you say the northeast? No. What would you say?
It's northeast. That's
northeast.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Mainly east.
Right. And so buses are your principal form of public transport.
We have no heavy rail. We have no light rail. Buses are all we have. And it's an effective network because it spreads throughout the city. It radiates. And that's effective. In fact, we have buses bypassing stops because they're full in the peak. And it's a turn-up-and-go system in the morning peak, and that's very effective. But in the end, in the east, as part of the Eastern Transport Coalition, we're actually calling for a network-wide review of buses in Victoria because the investment in rolling stock's not happening. There's no investment in additional kilometres. The bus ages are increasing on average. But when the government has invested, when they built the orbital routes through the city in recent years, or when they built the network for Manningham, there was a significant uptick in patronage.
So there we are. If you build a better system, then people will start to use it because it's working well for them. Paul, thank you very much for that. I might go to Jane in Sydney. Now, Jane, you might be living there, but you want to talk about Perth.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that the loop system that some of your callers have mentioned exists in Perth, but unfortunately it is in the CBD and not in the suburbs, but they have two buses called CATS, and one does a north to south roughly and one does an east to west, but they loop continuously and they have a countdown on the stand so you know how far off it is, and it's just very convenient and very sensible. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear that Perth has got something working well for that city. I might come back to our guests to wrap up here because we're running out of time. Sandy Weiger, can I come to you as a long-time planning consultant on a whole range of areas, including how to make sure communities and public transport match when it comes to new developments? What can we learn from this conversation? Where to from here?
I think probably the key learning is really we have to be looking at what it is that people are needing now and in the next few years, and working out, well, what can we do? I think that there are small improvements that can be made in any system that can make big differences. And so it's not always about finding a new rail line or a new major road or whatever. There can be small fixes that will make people's lives a lot easier and help them to use public transport.
Thank you so much for that. And quickly to you, John.
Yes, I think density done well is fundamental, both in the hubs and in the growth suburbs, but also that first mile, last mile public transport.
Okay, it's been a fascinating conversation and great to hear contributions from everyone around the country about what they've seen work and what could be better. My guests are John Stanley, Professor of Transport at the University of Sydney, and also longtime town planning consultant Sandy Weiger, who knows very well what's happening in the north of this country, particularly in Queensland, and some of the success stories in that area as well. If you'd like to contribute to this planning and public transport Bursting City series, you can do so on Life Matters by email. LifeMatters@abc.net.au.